Turn with me to begin with to Revelation chapter 13, and as you're turning there, a little review on things that were said before regarding chapter 12. In chapter 12, you will recall the devil is cast down. You will notice, as we did perhaps then when we were looking at this, that the devil is described in a particular way. He is described as, well, let's just read it for ourselves in Revelation chapter 12, if you're already there. Verse 3, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the earth, and so on. He was there, this great fiery red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and the diadems on his head, was there to devour the male child as he was born. Of course, the male child being Christ. Now, we're told who this seven-headed dragon was. Over in verse 9, it says, so the great dragon was cast down, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. So this is that's who the dragon is. The scripture itself here tells us. We don't have to interpret it. It interprets it for us. The seven-headed dragon, 10 horns, is the devil. Now, I call your attention to that, to the description, 7 heads and 10 horns, because there's a specific reason that he's described that way. I want you to look at what happens when he's cast down. We talked about this before, just to review briefly. He goes after the church, goes after the woman that bore the male child. Then he goes, we see, he goes after the remnant or the remainder of her seed, meaning the church, and we understand this to refer to the final conflict in the end time. We understand that because we read that he knows his time is short. So he goes after those described as who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So that's who this seven-headed, ten-horned dragon pursues. He goes after the church. Again, this is the final conflict in earth's history. It precedes the second coming. Now, how does he go after the church? Well, we'll tell that in chapter 13. I want to focus on a verse or two, and we'll go elsewhere, and then we'll come back to this. But look at chapter 13. It says, then I stood on the sand of the sea. Presumably, this was John saying, I stood on the sand of the sea. But, you know, there's an alternative translation or manuscript here that says, then he stood on the sand of the sea. And it's just been talking about the seven-headed dragon. He stood on the sand of the sea. What for? Yeah, what is the sea in apocalyptic literature? And this is apocalyptic literature. It's the Word of God, but it's apocalyptic in genre. What is the sea? What does the sea represent? It's the habitation of evil. The habitation of evil. You know, the bottomless pit is perceived to be at the bottom of the sea. It's in the deepest part of the bottom of the sea. That's where the bottomless pit is presumed to be in apocalyptic literature. And this is where the most vile of demons exist. And so here you have the devil, if indeed that translation or that particular manuscript is correct, the seven-headed, ten-horned dragon, Satan the devil, standing on the seashore, obviously looking out over the sea. For what purpose? Well, remember, he's about to pursue those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And now he's going to call forth, as it were, his chief agents in doing that job. Let's read it here again. Then he, meaning the devil, stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. So evidently the devil here is depicted as calling this beast from the sea to act as his agent. And now I want you to notice the description of the beast. Remember the description of the devil, the seven-headed, ten-horned dragon. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea having 7 heads and 10 horns. So it's made in the image and after the likeness of the devil, isn't he? You see the similarity here. The devil who calls forth the beast to act as his agent has his own image bearer. You see a counterfeit at work here. God made man in his own image and after his own likeness. We also see the same language applied to God the Father and Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is called the image of the invisible God, and he is the new Adam and so forth. And so here we see a counterfeit of God the Father and Christ the Son. This is the false God, the God of this world, calling forth his Son, as it were, to do his work, to act as his agent in this world, who is obviously an antichrist. An antichrist figure here. So the beast having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now, I want you to notice further the description in chapter 2, in verse 2, I should say. And notice carefully the way this is described. We're going to come back to this. It says, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear." Here you have a leopard, a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Leopard, bear, lion. Those are some pretty fierce creatures right there, aren't they? Pretty strong animals. "The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." Once again, you see the counterfeit, don't you? Between God the Father and Jesus Christ and the seven-headed, ten-horned dragon and the seven-headed, ten-horned beast. Now then, let's leave this. We'll come back to it a little later and look at it in a little more detail. Well, let's go to the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel. Now, many commentators, I think most commentators who say anything about the book of Revelation, will admit and will agree to the fact that it is intimately connected with the book of Daniel. In order to fully grasp and understand, comprehend Revelation, you need those prophecies, very basic prophecies, in the book of Daniel. Because they are connected, clearly connected. In Daniel chapter 2, we've covered this in the past. I'm not going to dwell spend a whole great deal of time on it. But just to summarize it, you will recall that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, this is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, had a dream. And the dream is described here in Daniel chapter 2. And it turns out that this is a prophetic dream. And only Daniel can give him the accurate interpretation of it. I'm just going to summarize it for you. Remember the dream. In the dream, he saw an image. The image had a head of gold. The head of gold represents the Neo-Babylonian Empire. That's Nebuchadnezzar's own empire, as Daniel says here in chapter 2. Oh, you can read the details for yourself. I just want to give you this brief summary. The chest and arms of silver represent the Medo-Persian Empire, which succeeded the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And then the belly and sides of brass represent the Greco-Macedonian Empire, the Grecian Empire, first king being Alexander the Great, and then you had the four generals which came later. But this is represented by that belly and sides of brass. And then finally, the legs of iron and feet of iron and clay represents the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire. Now, something interesting you see about this, well, perhaps if I have time, I'll come back and comment on it, regarding the end of the matter here. But anyway, let's go on to another prophecy. This one is in Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, and you will find several beasts mentioned here. It's another vision. This vision takes place about 50 years after the first vision. You may not realize there's that much time because you can read through it a whole lot faster than that. But if you look at the dates here, the given said the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. This was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. This vision happened in about 50 years after the Nebuchadnezzar dream vision. Okay? And it's interesting because he outlines the same things, but in different language. Now, you will recall what I said in a recent message. Was it the last time or the time before? Anyway, recently. Those of you who were here will remember what I said about the concept of recapitulation. And some of you said, I wasn't familiar with that word. You're familiar with the word recap. And I'm not talking about, what the tires on your old Chevy out there. But recap is to repeat or retell or simply to summarize or hit the major points. And recapitulation, when you're talking about Bible prophecy, is to have different visions which both speak of the same thing, the same series of events, and yet describe it in different terms. Remember the analogy I gave you, the football game. It's in the final play of the game, and you have Auburn against LSU. Auburn has the ball, 10 yards from the goal line. And then the ball is snapped, and Auburn scores, wins the game, beats the daylights out of LSU. I say that for your benefit, of course. But then you have the recap. To recap, then they talk about who did what, how the quarterback did and what the wide receiver did, or this, that, or other person. And you also have the playback, which is a form of recap or recapitulation. And you have cameras on the sidelines, cameras in front and back, on the droids overhead, and all of those things. And you can watch that same play from all these different angles. And that's what you see in much of biblical prophecy. You see sometimes a vision, like the Nebuchadnezzar's dream image, of that image, it represents the succession of empires. Then you see another prophecy, and you find out, lo and behold, it represents the same things, only it tells you in different symbols. Same with the, different angles on that last play of the game that Auburn won. That you see different angles. You can see exactly what the quarterback was doing from this angle. You can see exactly what somebody else is doing, what the defense on the other side was doing, mistakes that were made, the good things that happened, the best moves in the play, and all of that. You can analyze it thoroughly. So that's what you have here. In Daniel chapter 7, you see a recap. You see a recapitulation going on here. Let's look at this particular vision. Let's begin in verse 3. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion. Remember what I called your attention to a few moments ago. Remember that beast in Revelation 13, the one that bears the image and likeness of his father, as it were, the devil. That beast is described as what three animals did we mention? Lion is one of them, right? So this first great beast came up from the sea, and different from the others. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Now, interestingly enough, in ancient Babylon, that particular figure was quite common. A winged lion with human face. And this is obviously in reference to that Neo-Babylonian Empire. The same thing the head of gold symbolized. The first was like a lion, had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. This is probably a reflection of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar himself. The fact that he had these 7 insane years when he was like a wild animal, and then the human spirit returned to him, and so this is most likely a reference to that. And of course, it's put here in order to identify that particular kingdom, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. What did we read in Revelation 13? Bear was one of the animals mentioned, right? It was raised up on its side. This raising up on its side no doubt represents the dominance of the Persians over the Medes. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. The dominance of the Persians over the Medes. So you could call this simply the Persian Empire. Raised up on one side, and 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus, arise, devour much flesh. These 3 ribs no doubt represent Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt, which were conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire. Verse 6, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard. There's that other animal we were talking about, right? Another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. Now, a leopard is a very fast animal. you add the wings to it, it's really fast, isn't it? It can swoop in a hurry, couldn't it? That's exactly the way Alexander went about conquering the world, in this blitzkrieg style. So a leopard would be an apt description here, a winged leopard at that. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So these first two beasts had one head each, and this one has four. Four, that's a total of six, isn't it? Six heads. But here you have the four-headed beast. What do those four heads stand for? Well, remember that Alexander, once he had become the first king, once he'd conquered the world, in a manner of speaking, once he had done what he did, he died rather young. Some question remains about precisely how he died. But in any case, he died young. And his four generals carved up his empire into four segments. You know, there were the Syrian kings in the north, you had the Ptolemies in Egypt, and then you had the others, you had Cassander and Lysimachus, the other two, the two generals. And so they divided up the empire into four, represented by these four heads. Now then you come to something else here. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. The implication you get here is it's much stronger than the preceding, which themselves were no weaklings. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. Now, in what way was this fourth kingdom different? Well, before I explain that, I'll just pause to mention here that because all of this was written, according to the text itself, was written during the time of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, many modern scholars would tell you that this couldn't possibly have actually been written then, because all these things did unfold just as Daniel says. So what they're doing, they're throwing out the possibility even of a supernatural component here. In other words, they don't really believe that God inspired this prophecy. Otherwise, why would they have to put the writing of Daniel down in the 2nd century B.C.? Down in the time of the Syrian kings, and particularly during the time of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who wreaked havoc among the Jews and vowed to destroy the Jewish people until he was struck dead himself. So, all of these prophecies, they say, must refer to that period. Couldn't possibly back up in time, so what they say is, well, he's just reviewing some history and bringing it down to the time he lived, which is in the time of the Syrian kings, specifically the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So the way they reinterpret all of this is that they say the four kingdoms represent Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. No, this is not talking about the Grecian kingdom. That third beast is the Grecian kingdom. I think that's clear enough. The four heads, all of it is clear enough. This is something different. And it really doesn't fit that one head or that one segment of the divided Grecian kingdom. This is a beast that is far more powerful than the others. It tramples, it crushes, and it has dominion that is more extensive and in some way very different from the three before it. So it says it was different from all the beasts that were before it. If you look at a map, you can do a Google search on it and find it for yourself. Look up, go to images, Google images, and look up maps for each one of those empires. Babylonian Empire or Neo-Babylonian Empire. Then the Greek, look up Medes and Persians and Greeks and all of that. And then Romans. Rome is number four, the Roman Empire. And this is obviously what it's talking about, and it was different in what way? Well, a number of ways, but one way in which the Roman Empire differed from the others is because of its Western orientation. You'll see that the preceding three are more of an Eastern orientation. They take up basically the same territories with some variation there. And Rome takes up much of what's in the east there, as well as much more, it's much more westward. It goes into Europe. So you see, the Roman Empire was different in this regard. And he says, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them. Now here's some detail in this recapitulation, if you want to call it that. It says it's not supplied in chapter 2. But chapter 2 does tell us this. Let's go back there to chapter 2 and see how what the end of the matter is. It says, and in the days of these kings, verse 44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. First of all, the feet of partly of iron and part of clay. The last kingdom we know of here is the Roman Empire. With the feet, part of iron, part of clay, it has that weakness mixed with the strength. And it says, and in the days of these kings, it's talking about the end, the latter part. In other words, the Roman kingdom. And I would say this, that many, many Jews in the time of Jesus could read this and understand it. And they would look at that and they would see that clearly what is described next is the Messiah's kingdom. Messiah comes and establishes a kingdom. When? In the days of these kings. So no wonder messianic expectations were so high in the time of Jesus, at least among some. Those who studied the scriptures and who were aware of this text. And I would say that was fairly widespread knowledge in those days. But anyway, he goes on. Let's just read how it's put here. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces. Same kind of language here. It shall break in pieces. Only this is going to break in pieces even the one who broke in pieces before. And consume all these kingdoms, and it, unlike the others, shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will have come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. So here you have, obviously, takes you right down to the kingdom of God, doesn't it? And yet, this comes right at the end of the description of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire. So what would that tell you? Since the kingdom of God has not come yet, at least not as described here, you know, the eschatological kingdom, and I think this is a pretty clear description of that. Since that kingdom, the eschatological, the final kingdom, has not come yet, Christ has not returned, the stone cut out of the mountain has not yet struck the image on the feet, and yet, say, didn't Rome fall a long time ago? Well, so what would this suggest? That it must exist in some form in the end. And has it not really continued to exist in one sense in a disunited state? A disunited condition? Yeah, I would think so. And you see a little bit more detail in the chapter 7 prophecy. Again, verse 8, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, the liberal scholars would have you believe that this little horn is the same little horn described in chapter 8. In chapter 8, the little horn there is clearly Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. But they assume that this must be the same little horn. No, this is a different little horn. Because in chapter 8, that little horn comes up from among the four horns representing the generals that carved up Alexander's kingdom. And this little horn comes up among the ten. It's a different little horn. So let's not confuse those two. Let's not assume that we're talking about the Grecian kingdom here, which ended a long time ago. In the Maccabean revolt. No, this is not talking about that. And this kingdom that's established here is not due to the Maccabean revolt. No, this is something obviously has not happened yet. Now, he goes on to say, I watched till the thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated, and so it goes on to describe that. And he goes on in verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flames. After the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. Now see what this sounds like to you. One like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, he came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. That's exactly what we read in different words back in chapter 2 when it talked about the stone being cut out of the mountain without hands and striking the image on the feet. Here's a little more detail. Here we have one called the Son of Man. It's interesting, Jesus called himself Son of Man. Many scholars have connected this with the title Jesus took to him for himself. In other words, it's a messianic title. And the Jews of this period and of the first century knew this was messianic. And I think they knew his use of Son of Man in applying to himself was a connection to this. And then he goes on, let's read a little bit more here, skip on down through this. It says these great beasts in verse 17, which are four kings or four kingdoms. Kings represent kingdoms, which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with his teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. That's not Antiochus Epiphanes in the Syrian kings. That's not who he's talking about here. This is something far more dreadful than that. And the ten horns which were on its head, and the other horn which came up before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance is greater than his fellows. I'm not going to attempt to wade through the exact details of all this, but you get the picture here, don't you? He goes on to say down in verse 23, well, let's just look at 21, I was watching and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. That sounds like something the devil is doing there, doesn't it, in chapter 13, through his agent that bears his image and his likeness. Here, though, it's described as a little horn. Until the Ancient of Days came, doesn't mean came to the earth, but came to the judgment seat. Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. In other words, the judgment came, this final judgment, at a certain point after the little horn had waged war against the people of God. This judgment day, as it were, came. And now then, it's in favor of the people of God. You know what this means, obviously. Time to judge this Antichrist power and to give reward to the people who have been under persecution. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings, and he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. And the saints shall be given into his hand. Now here's language you find in Revelation 13 and other places in Revelation. For a time and times and half a time. 42 months, 1260 days, time, and half a times, all the same thing, which represents, which means, of course, 3.5 years, but it can be taken to mean, it could be taken symbolically to mean a broken seven. Seven being the number of completion, seven being, in this case, being the number of the completion of persecution and suffering upon God's people by the Antichrist force that's at work in the world. It could be a broken seven. In other words, those days shall be cut short, shall be shortened for the sake of the elect. It could refer simply to that. Either way, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter because those days will be shortened for the sake of the elect. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away the dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So now back to chapter 13. Chapter 13, here we read about this beast, and he has these same characteristics we see in these beasts of Daniel 7. We see that, don't we? I'll just mention in passing, I was going to go through it, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. In Daniel chapter 8, you have the vision of the ram and the he-goat. Now, that vision recapitulates the chest and arms of silver and the belly and sides of brass, as well as the second and third beasts of the prophecies of chapter 2 and chapter 7. It pertains to the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, which succeeded it, and the carving up of the kingdom into four. And there's an important reason for the insertion of that in that particular place, because this basically is saying, remember, Daniel is kind of, he's looking for this completion of he's looking for the end of this exile in Babylon. You know, that was something to look forward to, 70 years of exile under the Babylonians. And of course, Cyrus the Persian released them, brought them back to the land, let the Hebrews go back to the land, and they started rebuilding the temple and so on. But here in this period, when they're looking for that to take place, basically what God is saying is, yeah, what takes place is not going to end the persecution upon the people, though. It's not going to end the time of crisis for the people. You go back to your own land, guess what else? You're going to have other powers dominating you. And here's the way it will turn out under the Persians and under the Greeks. And guess what? As bad as this one little horn in chapter 8, Antiochus Epiphanes, as bad as he is, as much havoc as he wreaks, everybody wreaks havoc, but as much persecution as he brings upon the people and suffering as he brings upon the people, you have to remember this. We haven't even come to the fourth kingdom yet that has dominion. You know, officially, you know, according to the historians, Augustus Caesar was the first emperor of Rome. And that was coming right down close to the time of Christ, by the time that the Roman Empire began, much closer, a good ways after. I didn't write down the exact dates, but a little ways after the time of the Syrian kings and the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. I think, according to the Bible, if you look at what the Bible says about the kings of this fourth kingdom, it probably counts Julius Caesar. He probably count as an emperor, although not officially an emperor, since he had the Senate make him dictator in perpetuity, using that word, dictator. But anyway, I think he probably qualifies as the first ruler of Rome in the Roman Empire, but it wasn't really considered an empire until his nephew, Augustus Caesar, came to the throne. In any case, by the time the Roman kingdom begins, it's not too far from the birth of Christ. It's not too far out from that. Whereas the Syrian kings were quite a bit earlier, you know, just looking at it on a time chart. But chapter 8 of Daniel tells us of these, the succession there between the Greeks, or I should say between the Medes and Persians and the Greeks. And yet the fourth kingdom hasn't even come about yet. And this is quite a ways out from or past the Babylonian deportation and return. So obviously, by the time Christ came, under the Roman, the fourth kingdom was in place by this time. And by this time, the people's expectations for the coming deliverer were quite high. You have all this stuff laid out in Daniel. It keeps pointing to the fourth kingdom and connecting that, the fourth kingdom, with the coming of the Messiah. And then when Messiah comes, what does he say? He says, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It seems pretty clear, doesn't it? The kingdom of heaven was at hand. And it was, in one sense. But back to chapter 13 now. Revelation chapter 13. And taking up, continuing in verse 3. And I saw one of the heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast because this deadly wound was healed. And they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. What do you call that? Violation of commandment number one. Having another god before the true God. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. There you have that same period. 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in him. Look at all the commandments that are being broken here. They worship the beast. They worship Satan. They worship the beast. And then the beast himself opens his mouth in blasphemy. And later on, you'll find the second beast makes an image to the first beast, and they worship that. So you have idolatry. You have worshiping false gods. You have idolatry. You have taking his name in vain. And of course, they go after the saints. You have murder, commandment after commandment after commandment is being trampled upon, and they're going after the people who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. So if you're a commandment keeper in these times, then it may not be good fortune for you in the short term. It was granted him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. This is exactly what we read about the fourth beast in Daniel 7. Now, the reason the fourth beast, this beast is described as having all these features of the previous three beasts or kingdoms is because, obviously, the Roman kingdom absorbed the strength of these other kingdoms. It had the same strengths these previous kingdoms had, but now concentrated in its own kingdom, which had a Western orientation. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. And he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills by the sword must be killed by the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. In other words, he's calling upon the saints to have patience and faith in this time of suffering. Now, the saints here are not just the ones who were left behind, quote unquote. The rest were taken, the real good guys were taken away in the rapture. Or those who were already converted at this time were taken away, but the ones who became converted during this tribulation period were remained behind. No, there's nothing like that here. Saints are saints are saints. They're the people of God. Remember, the devil goes after the people who keep the commandments. The impression you get of those who have been keeping the commandments and holding the testimony of Jesus. They hadn't already been raptured out. So there's no secret rapture that fits very well into this. And then you have the description of the second beast. I'm not going to go in depth into this, but the second beast comes up out of the earth. It has two horns, and it really is the supporter and promoter of the first beast. because he makes an image to the beast and gives life to the image of the beast and so on. You have the description here. This obviously represents a religious aspect. So you have here the secular, the first beast. You have the, well, its original, keep in mind, its original manifestation was in Imperial Rome. Imperial Rome. Now then, what was the original manifestation of the second beast, which was the religious aspect? Well, notice that this first beast demanded worship of itself. Did any of the Roman emperors ever receive worship from the people? Yeah, and when they found out it really gave them greater control, they started enforcing it. And who did they use to enforce it? Well, they had their enforcers. It was the imperial cult that went about seeing to it, at a certain point in time, seeing to it that the people offered a little bit of incense or something, some kind of symbol showing their allegiance to the emperor. And the emperor was hailed as himself being divine. You know, the dead emperors were thought to have ascended to heaven and now taken their seats among the gods. So the imperial cult was enforcing emperor worship. Now, this was a problem if you happen to be a Christian and your allegiance was to Christ. So this is what you had going on. Now then, there have been other manifestations. Let's remember that the Roman Empire didn't end with the, you know, what we think of as the fall of Rome. Didn't end in ancient history that's ancient to us. But actually, we see, well, let's just take a look at this. Hold your place here. Let's go over to chapter 19 and see something that takes place. Now remember that hereafter, after chapter 13, for example, you see it in chapter 16 and verse 13, chapter 19 and verse 20, and chapter 20 and verse 10. This first beast, the beast out of the sea, is called simply the beast. And the second beast, the one that arises out of the earth, is called the false prophet. So beast and false prophet are these two beasts, one from the sea, one from the earth. But look at chapter 19. In chapter 19, it's obviously here describing, beginning with verse 11, it's describing the second coming of Christ. Read on down to verse 17. Let's just begin down in verse 17. It says, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun and cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God." And this is a feast you don't want to attend. "That you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and those who sit on them." Sounds like something you would read in Zechariah 14. "And the flesh of all the people, free and small, free and slave and small and great. And I saw the beast." Now wait a minute. He's still there? If that's the Roman kingdom, you mean, what's he doing here at the time of Christ's second coming? Well, there's obviously an end-time manifestation of this same system, isn't there? That's obvious. "The kings of the earth, their armies gathered together to make war with him who sat on the horse and against his army. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet." There you have both the beasts of chapter 13. The one out of the sea and the one out of the earth. Both of them are captured. When? At the second coming of Christ. So to leave the Roman Empire, both of these beasts, in ancient history is a mistake. You see, there's an end-time manifestation of this same system that merges religion and secular state. "These two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone, and the rest were killed with a sword." So this is the demise, the ultimate demise of that system. We might call it the beast system. And so what we see here, again, is that even though the people, the original recipients of Revelation, were living during the reign of the fourth beast, they actually saw this. And make no mistake about it, when they read this description or when they heard this description read to them in their probably house churches, You know, it was sent out to John, had it sent out to these different, the seven churches in Asia. When people began to read this or hear these words, don't think for a minute that they scratched their heads and said, what in the world could that mean? They knew exactly what it meant. They knew exactly who this seven-horned or the seven-headed, ten-horned beast was, because they'd lived under its persecution already in the first century, the second, late first century, and in the second and third centuries, all the way down to the Edict of Milan, when finally the persecution began to let up under Constantine. And then you had a whole new set of problems emerge when you had Christianity merging with the state and becoming friendly with the state, the Roman state. So, yeah, you see, that's the way things worked out. And so these people did, no doubt, these people recognized exactly who this beast was. And they recognized the original manifestation of the second beast, which had been the imperial cult. Now, later on, interestingly enough, that second beast would take the form of an apostate Christianity, because it became a tool of the state to do its dirty biddings. And they kind of used each other, as it were. You know how that worked out in history. You remember the persecution of so-called heretics, how they were exiled under imperial authority, exiled from the kingdom, sent off into far-off lands because they didn't agree with whatever the bishops came up with and was agreed to by Constantine himself originally, and then other emperors. So you have this same system existing in one form or another in ages past. And some people look at that and say, well, maybe an end time revival of the papacy, because the present papacy, this just doesn't fill the bill. No way. The current pope is about as left wing and liberal and far off out there, away from this as you can get. So many people think that, there's going to be a comeback someday. Well, look at Europe. We think about a 10-nation European Union dominated by the Roman Catholic Church with a very powerful papacy. But, boy, things have got to change drastically in Europe for that to happen. Well, you have all these old cathedrals that are basically empty nowadays. They're more atheist now, probably, than Christian. Well, that may not be true, but, you know, that's the claim. But you do have a religious force there, and I wouldn't make any guesses about this. You can take it for what speculate about it if you'd like. There is a very strong religious force on the rise in Europe. It's called Islam. You know, I've wondered about that. But sometimes I've looked at these texts and said, but Islam, you know, they're enforcing worship of a system. And they say Allah alone, God alone is to be worshipped. Even Muhammad is not worshipped. No prophet is ever to be worshipped. And they believe in Jesus, but Jesus is not to be worshipped. Allah alone is to be worshipped. But you know that in reality, any system, anything you put ahead of God is a form of worship, is it not? So what if you have an apostate religion, one that does call for killing the enemies, killing Christians and Jews, killing people who do not conform? What if you have a state based on that? Is that not a form of submission to the state, and therefore making the state your God? Yes. A form of worshiping something? You know, anything you submit to is, if you submit to something other than God, then is that not considered idolatry in some form? Or false worship? So I don't know. You know, that's something to think about, something to ponder. In any case, there was a time I was convinced that the Roman Catholic Church would reform and become like it was in the Middle Ages, and the papacy would become like it was then, when you had, you know, you had a whole bunch of really extremely corrupt, adulterous, murderous popes. There's no question about that. And they did. They did fulfill this role in those ages. So I used to think in terms that we would see that again, but now I'm really not convinced of that. I don't know that it'll play out that way. It could, but what we do know, is it will involve some kind of apostate religious system and the strong arm of the state merged together. And we do know with this same system that existed in ancient Rome, or in the Roman kingdom, under the various emperors, the system we see back there, the system that the people of God have suffered under, been persecuted by in ages past, will have a manifestation in the end. That's what the beast and the false prophet are. That we can say for sure. But you know, if I'm running from the enemy, and I look down and see a hole in my body, somebody shot me, I don't think I'm going to say, "And I wonder if that was from a Catholic or a Muslim." Was that a German that did that? Or was Yeah. The enemies of God's people are the enemies of God's people, regardless who they are. But we do know this system, the same system, will have a resurgence in some form in the time of the end. So back to this same chapter that we were in, chapter 13. And, well, we won't take the time to go through, as I said, the second beast. But what happens here is, well, let's look at verse 15. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. So an image of the beast was made. The beast was wounded with a sword and lived. He was granted to give power to the beast, to the image of the beast, and the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So there you have idolatry, worshiping an image when it's made to speak, and enforcement of it under the death sentence. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark. That is to say, the mark, that is to say, that's a translation that I think adequately and accurately captures the intent here. The name of the beast, in other words, the mark represents the name. Mark of the beast is the name, and that represents the name. Or the number of his name, which also represents the name. So what do these people have? They have the name of the beast, whether in form of mark or a number, in their foreheads, in their right hand. And if they don't have it, they can't buy and sell. Meaning what? They suffer economic depravity, the economic deprivation. So that's, you know, and that's basically what actually that happened in earlier times when people refused to worship the emperor or to just acknowledge the emperor as a god. In some cases, when they refused to participate in the guild feasts, where the guild feasts honored pagan gods. When they refused those, then the guilds were like unions, and they were excluded, and then they suffered economically. So this is what you're reading about here, something like that in the end time. And then, but you see the contrast here. This is the really important thing. Rather than try to identify what that mark is, rather than talk on and on and on about whether or not computer chips will be, you know, put in us, into our foreheads or in our right hands, or on and on and on about how many different names you can find that could add up to 666, because there's a bunch of them out there. But in any case, rather than do that, the important thing here is to look at the contrast. Look at the contrast. Those who give their allegiance to the beast, this idolatrous, blasphemous beast, those who give their allegiance to it have the beast's name in one form or another in their forehead. That means they've given their allegiance to the beast. And yet, by contrast, in chapter 14, verse 1, just forget the chapter break, because you should see the contrast very clearly rather than think you're going on to another subject. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having the Father's name, not the beast's, but the Father's name written on their foreheads. You see the contrast? They've given their allegiance to the Father. Now there they are with the Lamb. And this proleptically looks to their ultimate destiny. The destiny of those who follow the beast is not so good. You see it in chapter 19. When the beast and the false prophet are thrown into the lake of fire, the rest are killed with a sword. But here, these are with the Lamb on Mount Zion. That's their destiny. And I think we know which side we want to be on in that day. Yeah. Between now and then, though, you know, and I don't know how all this will play out, but between now and then, it may well come to the time when you may be tempted to let go in order to save your own skin, in order to have food on the table, in order to extend your life a little longer. When in fact, what you need to look at is, you don't end with chapter 13. Look at that first part of chapter 14. That's what we're looking for. We want to keep the Father's name written in our foreheads, so that when that time does come, and when we are able to endure, and that's what the book of Revelation is really all about, it's a call to the saints to endure those difficult times, to endure persecution, hardships, suffering, and to stand with the Lamb on Mount Zion when that time comes.